Hello everyone. My name is Hugo and I will finish the CERN talks. So my colleagues talk about how we store the data on disk, how we store the data on tapes, but actually also how we distribute the data, because CERN is not the only place where we store data. And this presentation is about a project. It's an open source project called Rusio. It's a Python written software. And before entering into this project in detail, I would like to set you a little bit the scene. This is probably the most beautiful slide that you're going to see in my whole presentation. But at CERN, as my colleague mentioned, we have all these different open source systems that we develop or we contribute upstream, like, for example, Ceph. So we are focusing last on the last one, which is Rusio, on this presentation. This is a plot that I presented a few weeks ago, just to show you a little bit the scale of the data that we have to manage. So in the last 2 years, we actually have to store more data than in the last 70 years of the lab. And as you can see, this curve is getting more aggressive, and in the next 5 years, it's going even to be much more aggressive, which means that on a constant budget, we have to be very creative about how to tame that data deluge. Okay, so who knows about WLCG? Okay, one person, two, three person, four person, okay. So it's not very known because it's, okay, it was developed to handle the LHC program, but actually this is the largest computing grid in the world. CERN sits in the middle, so this is like an onion, where all the data produced by the LHC machines, they are stored at the CERN, which is what we call the TR0. And then we have to distribute the data around 170 different data centers across 42 countries. And this infrastructure is used by more than 42,000 people to actually do analysis of this data. We have physicists around the world, not only at CERN. So how do we distribute this data? No? How we can access the data that is originally stored at CERN from other places? So if you run storage systems, sometimes in your career you will get a user asking you, okay, my analysis at CERN, it's working very fast, I'm very close to the data. Can you actually make your storage system faster? Because I'm connecting from the US and you know, the performance is not great. I get this request very often, which means in our storage group, this is what actually means the user, no? Okay, how can you optimize a local POSIX workflow, you know, the physicist will write some script that is using basically some system calls on a link which is from the US to Geneva over transatlantic fibers over wide area network using Fuse protocol, you know? And the question, okay, how can we actually optimize that part? And the answer is like, we can make some tricks, but we are bound by the speed of light and we are not really going over it. So inside CERN, and this is just an example, a real example actually of the latencies that we have. So inside the data center, we have 0.25 milliseconds between two machines. So if you have a network file system, this latency, let's say for the analysis use cases that we have, is barely noticeable. But once you go to like the US or to other continents where you have much bigger latencies, this is, for example, a ping I did this morning, it's around 125 milliseconds. So this means for every operation that you have to do over the network, your operation is 400 times slower, which is not nice. So what do we do actually? You know, how can we optimize this? The answer is like, we cannot do it. So we have actually to copy the data from one place to another, so the data is analyzed locally on the remote system. This is an stupid example I did this morning, okay? I just straight a stupid program to count some lines, and just, you know, this stupid program has around 125 stat system calls and 400 reads to just count how many times the word your appears in the text. Actually, it was a Russian text, so there is not many, zero. Just to show you that you know, the physics analysis are much more complicated than that, so there are a lot of more system calls over the local kernel mount or the fuse mount, and when you have these wide area network links, the performance rapidly decreases. So, yeah, the answer is like when you have to really have local I/O performance, you actually need to ship the data to some place and then you do local operations on a bare metal on top of a local file system, or if you have a fast network interconnect, you do it inside your data center. So this means that we actually need to have a way, you know, a mechanism to move data from CERN to over these 170 different data centers that are distributed in the globe. So how we do it, you know, this is the typical when I have a student come into my office when I arrive for the first day of job. Okay, how can you transfer this data? Okay, let's SCP some data. Okay, you have a few megabytes, not a problem. When you have to transfer like billions of files containing around 1 petabyte of data, you can still leave it dry, but there are many things that will go wrong, right? And these are a few of the things that we have to deal on a daily basis, okay? We have network failures. Sometimes the network is not reliable. The software has some bugs, so at the end you may basically fail some transfers. Sometimes we have a lot of different countries that we have to transfer the data. Sometimes you have ISP restrictions between the countries. So for example, you may not transfer data to a Chinese computing center from the US, so you have to pass through Europe, etc. So there are a lot of logic involved to how to basically shift the data from one place to another. And also the typical question, you know, how we transfer. Are we confident that we transfer all the data and that we have not corrupted any of this data, right? So for doing that, we cannot just use STP or whatever tool. We have to have like, robust and systems that have some state that understand the data that we are transferring and to do some analysis on this data to see if the data has been corrupted. So this is what I'm going to talk. This project is called Rusio and actually solves many of these problems. So Rusio is an open source project that started in the Atlas experiment at CERN. So it has over 10 years of operational experience. And the Atlas experiment decided to open up for the community a few years ago. And now it's used in many scientific communities that I will mention later. So Rusio is free, it's open source, it's on GitHub, has a permissive license, Apache V2. And it provides actually a scientific data management platform. So you have data that you need to distribute to many of the different sites. You register this data in Rusio. You don't need to run Rusio in all of your computer centers. This is a nice part about Rusio. It's just a middleware that runs in some place, and then it just has a catalog of the data, where the data is sitting, has a pointer to all these data centers, which means that it's location aware, and it's heterogeneous. Because imagine you have 170 data centers in different countries. You cannot just say, okay, you all use the same technology, so we, you know, the life is great. So every country will have their own technologies that they would like to use, etc. So you need to have something that actually under these heterogeneous technologies. So what are the functionalities that Rusio provides? I will not enter into all of them, but a few of them is that it's horizontally scalable. The namespace is a SQL database that you can bind. You can use Postgres, SQLite, or Oracle. It transfers between different storage facilities. It can be these facilities, tapes, or HPC, cloud systems as well. And actually provides different authentication mechanisms, so the user can authenticate with Kerberos, with SSH keys, he can authenticate with OpenID tokens, or with X509, like TLS client certificates. This is a high-level overview of the architecture. So in the top, we have the clients. We have CLI clients, Python SDKs, REST API, and a web interface, so you can actually use these interfaces to access the system. And then there are different components. The most important ones are the daemons. Daemons are like independent processes. These are Python processes, multi-threaded, that what they do is like they connect to the database, they obtain some job, they do some processing, and then they store it back in the database so other daemons can work on that. And at the end, we have different transfer protocols, like S3 or like pure HTTP with WebDAV, and some other ones that probably you don't know about, like Globus, which is more orientated to scientific data. Yeah, and that's basically it. Yeah, what is the most important thing about Rusio is that it's a system that is declarative. You don't tell Rusio how you want to transfer the data. You basically express how you want to see the data in different data centers with a declarative language. So for example, you can say, I want 3 copies of this data in 3 continents and at least 1 on a tape system. You can say with a rule, I want 1 copy of this file anywhere but on a fast disk. And you can define like quality of service per data center about which, let's say, what are the capabilities of each data center. This is what we call the replication rules. So when there is a need to copy the data to some place, just create a replication rule. Just one simple command in the CLI, and then there are thousands, if not millions, of transfers that are created on the back of the system to transfer this data and to verify that the data is actually correct, not corrupt, etc. Or you can do it automatically. This is what is called subscriptions. You can say all the data that comes from this computing center or has this metadata, because you can attach metadata to every file or catalog, you can create transfers. So for example, you have like a data workflow that you are writing into the system. You can trigger a replication rule automatically through the subscription, so then the data is copied to other systems. This is just the concept in Rusio. It's what we call the Rusio namespace. The Rusio namespace is consisting of files and data sets and containers. Containers will disappear. My colleague Dimitro can tell you more about this. files and data sets is like is our the virtual abstraction about a file and a directory in a normal file system. And this is how we explain basically all the data that is cataloged in Rusio. So we have a scope, and then we have a name. And this is unique. You cannot change it. And once you basically mint it, it's like, you cannot repudiate it, let's say. It's persistent. What I mentioned before also is that in Rusio you can explain different queries with metadata. So when you register the data, you can actually add like a JSON payload describing which metadata that you want. This is arbitrary. And then you can create rules based on that metadata. So it's quite flexible on that regard. And these interfaces are actually even being enhanced right now with different projects. On the operation side, what is in the day-to-day of operating this service? The objective actually to minimize the operations of human people, because at the end this is one of the most, let's say, costly factors in every organization. We try to optimize the human cores. And not having a person that has to do the transfers, but the system that does it automatically for you is really great. And moreover, it also means that when you have, you don't have a system like that, you have to understand all the protocols. And you know, if Amazon decides to change the SDK and then breaks incompatibility with on-premise S3 clusters, but you have to follow up this. Well, in this case, it's the Rusio software that will handle these upgrades for you. And the last thing is like, you know, how the transfers, they actually move from one place to another. And this is a great topic. But actually, Rusio does not proxy the data from one place to another. We actually expanded this community of WCG created an expansion of WebDAV, is what we call the third-party copy mechanism, and this is a peer-to-peer copy. How does it work? Like you have a client, issues an HTTP copy command to server A, and there is a header which is called source about the file that you want to copy to server A, and then the server A it will use an HTTP GET to get the data, while the client gets some performance metrics out of the server A. And this is how it works, because you don't want to have one single system, or even if it's distributed and you can horizontally scale, to proxy all the data through one single plane for 170 computer centers. So this is peer-to-peer, and this is just simply like extension of WebDAV. And that's it. Just to mention that this project is used in many physics scientific organizations and some astrophysics ones. And we are looking forward, actually, if there is other interest in other communities, or you are looking or you have the same needs for transferring big data sets across different countries or different institutions, this could be a nice project to contribute to. So that's it from my side. Thank you. I am fast. Any questions?
You said once you create a file, you cannot change the name. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So what happens if you do a typo? Because you're human.
Yeah. So basically, the question is, what happens if we change an identifier? So in Rusio, there is a concept that when you create an identifier, you keep it open until you are very sure that this is the state that you want, and then you have like a double commit phase. You can say, okay, I close now this DID, and then if you wrongly mistype it, then what do you do actually, Dimitrov in Atlas? Is a good answer. Dimitris was with us in the same team. So you can grab him if you want a specific, from operations perspective, if it happens in real life, what are the tricks that you can do? Okay, any other questions? Yeah?
Do you keep any metadata on the Rusio portal, the file that can be later set something?
Yeah, so the question is, can we add metadata so the files are searchable? Yes, absolutely. You can use a key-value pairs when you subscribe the data, and you can also put like a JSON file, and then basically you can issue queries on this metadata.
Okay.
One more question. Yeah, so basically when you tell Russia that, sorry, the question is, if you want to download the data, is it proxy through Russia or it's basically obtained directly from the storage systems? And the answer is you can get it directly from the storage systems. So you ask Russia where the data is sitting, and then Russia will do the magic to find the best copy available to you. Actually, it has some logic, where it's using basically JYP to find the closest computer center close to you, so it gives you the closest one, and then you download directly from the site. And you don't have to deal with authentication directly, this is handled in behind your back. Yeah?
You mentioned that the data placements are based on rules you write. Are these rules defined by the creator of the data or by the consumers, and are they like dynamic? For example, if I am a physicist in the US and try to access some data that is not in a US data center, can there will be changed for like some part of the data to be moved to the US data center for the next access?
Yeah, so the question is who handles, let's say, the creation of the rules and who defines the rules? So depends on the community. This will be my generic answer because every community has different needs. But for example, what I see on a daily basis is that there are some systems administrators that runs the Russia, let's say, instance of this project. And if the users, they get some quota, so they say they can transfer up to 50 terabytes across, let's say, all the computing centers. But if the request is more than 50 terabytes, it needs an approval from someone else. And Russia has built in this approval workflow, so you can define a threshold so the rule can be approved. Okay, so that's it. Thanks. Thank you.